Happy New Year. And today on the show, something a little bit different. I was contacted recently by a high school student in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, named Paul. And Paul had a project to do for his psychology class, and he chose as a topic public education in America. And Paul had been listening to School Sucks podcast, and he wanted to use the show as a resource in his project, along with any additional information that that I could provide relevant to the way he wanted to treat the subject. So what you're going to hear today is a recording of a Skype conversation that we had a little over a week ago. And sure, there's some review in it of things that have already been talked about on the show, along with some new information as well. And I also want to include it because this is what the show is supposed to be about, you know, like connecting with young people, especially people who are still in school. So Paul also heard about the show, interestingly enough, from his honors English teacher, who has been listening and telling students about it, apparently. So I really appreciate that. I think that's very cool. And hopefully he can keep that up at least until somebody from the teachers union shows up at his house and breaks his kneecaps with an aluminum baseball bat. But in the meantime, thanks for doing that. I really appreciate it. Also, making its debut on the show today, the Sony EMC MS907 condenser microphone lent to me by Stefan Molyneux. This is actually a mic that he used to use to record Free Domain Radio. He went through the trouble of shipping it to me from Canada in an effort to help me improve the sound quality of School Sucks podcast. So big, big thanks to him. I really appreciate it. And I thought that was very thoughtful. It actually got here the day after Christmas. I ripped the package open, plugged it in, tried it out, compared it to the other microphone that I was using before. And boy, it was Christmas all over again. I really think it made a huge difference. But I'm only using it today to record just the intro to this conversation that I had with Paul, kind of to test it out. People have been pretty good about giving me feedback about the sound quality for the show, since I think I'm kind of deaf in that area. I just wanted to test it before I used it to record a whole episode of the show. And if you're listening and you have some thoughts or some feedback, you can definitely throw it in an email like, Brett, you need to take it out of your mouth, or you need to turn the screeny looking end towards your face. Any of that would be helpful. But it sounds to me, through the tests I've done, that it's going well so far. Certainly a big improvement. And I know I can probably improve a little bit more. But thanks again to Steph. I really appreciate him sending this to me to use for a while on the show. Also, Jason Osborne contacted me recently, and he is working on getting me a speaking spot at the 2010 Liberty Forum, which is in Nashua, not too far away from where I am. And I would look forward to doing that if all goes well. It's certainly a much larger in-person audience than I'm used to, having been a teacher in the past. I'd be willing to take any suggestions about what people think such a speech should include, assuming that it does go through and I do get an opportunity to do that. And speaking of Jason Osborne, he's also a sponsor of the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of liberty-oriented podcasts that streams continuously online, something that Ian Freeman of Free Talk Live set up, I think, just within this last year. It includes shows in addition to Free Talk Live, Free Domain Radio, Complete Liberty Podcast, Liberty Conspiracy, Anti-War Radio, and a number of others. So School Sucks Podcast is now in the lineup of the Liberty Radio Network. So we're definitely in good company, and I'm interested and excited to see how that might help the show in the future. And just in one more quick note, I'm sorry if I created any confusion with what appeared to be a new episode called Episode 1, The Business Plan. Because new people are starting to discover the show, I thought it would be worth my time to re-record the first episode. I actually wound up splitting it into two separate installments. One went into the place of the original first show. The other one needed a new spot to be created in the feed. I thought I could backlog it to the appropriate time in August of 2009, but that didn't appear to work. All of that will be straightened out when we move the entire feed to the new website, which should be appearing within the next 2 or 3 weeks, hopefully. Also, thanks to Marcij Harabash, who is in Poland and designed a number of really interesting logo options for us that we're working now to incorporate into the design of that site. And I will mention that again because he definitely worked very hard to put something out or to put something together for us. So anyway, that's what's new. Like I said, Happy New Year, Happy 2010, and here is my discussion with Paul from Great Barrington on the topic of public education. Thanks for listening, and take care.
Original like idea behind the project was to pick a topic and tell about the psychological aspects of it. And so listening to your podcast, I got the idea to do in school the different uses of psychology. And then after we talked last and I was reading the article by Gatto, I got the idea that what I would do is start off by kind of saying that the purpose, I guess, of schools is to kind of limit and control, mold, whatever, the populace of the country, and then kind of use the presentation I have to give and my paper that I have to write to explain kind of how that happens. And so I know you have done kind of a lot of looking into the public school system, and so I thought that maybe you could provide some very useful information.
Well, I think, first of all, that, public school doesn't exist in history as this, lone villain for how to control how people think. It's the latest incarnation of a long line of these types of systems that really work to render a large population of individuals who, people tend to be creative, people tend to be imaginative, people tend to think on their own. And the goal of large-scale social management systems is to make people predictable. So obviously before government school in America or government-run school systems in Prussia, which is the forerunner to the American system, the way that this was accomplished was really with religion. If you had a large mass of people who would accept or swallow, basically, hook, line, and sinker, a belief system, they were very predictable. Their opinions on certain issues would be A, their actions following up those opinions would be B, and it made the goal of managing that population much easier. I think that, human history is really a continuous story that just kind of loops over and over again of a very, very small group of people controlling a very, very large group of people, either by fear or by force or some combination of the two. And really, to keep that going, when you think about how small the managing group is and how large the managed group is, the people need to be kind of reduced into a uniform and predictable populace to perpetuate that.
Okay. And so now then, even though it's not the only one, school is one of the tools that's used, correct?
Indeed, yeah.
Okay. So then they, like how you brought up the three hidden lessons and, all those things. And so within the school, it has its own tools for doing this.
Yeah, but it's not. I'm careful about how to talk about this because I often worry that I make it sound like it's some kind of large scale conspiracy that everybody is in on, from Barack Obama down to your psychology teacher, and that's not really the truth. I mean, a lot of the teachers that you've dealt with in your life, whether they were young or old, or regardless of the subject they taught, I could almost guarantee you that they got into education because they wanted to make a difference in the lives of young people. They were, you know, optimistic, and they went into teaching to do good, not to just have a job that had, you know, a lot of security. I know we talked in the before about how that young energetic teacher has a way of becoming that sort of old, angry, I know you said you had dealt with a couple people like that. I think everybody is familiar with that type of old teacher who just is kind of phoning it in as far as what they're doing in class. The system has a way of making the young guy into the old guy. It's not right. Necessarily two distinct personalities. It's just a difference of time spent in the system. Because the system is a very large bureaucracy. I just read an article on my show written by Jonathan Taylor Gatto, who spent 30 years as a public school teacher, who said it's essentially a jobs project. It's heavily influenced by the teachers union. Their goal is to basically get all teachers to be treated in the same way. So that means kind of pulling along the people who are completely incapable of being educators, while at the same time not rewarding the people who are really good. So it kind of just mixes everybody into this foggy middle. And that's, I mean, the problem with education is that it's really, public education is above all that it's funded coercively. So when the funding is coming from people who don't have a choice about whether they want to support the service or not, any kind of regard for quality from the point of view of the service providers is out the window. They don't have to worry about delivering a quality product. They are not going to go out of business, right? Because money is always streaming in from taxpayers. Now, this doesn't mean that this is an attitude that every single teacher in the system inherits. Like I said before, it's just that kind of bureaucratic culture that nothing really needs to get done because nothing is really at stake. And it's really a tragedy that the thing that they're trying to get done is to this so important process of educating young people falls in the hands of a slow and rusty, inefficient bureaucracy like the public education system.
Right. And like I've been looking up different articles and things, and all of them, or not all of them, I shouldn't say that, but many of them that I read through seem to kind of come to the conclusion at some point that a better way, I guess, to run it would be to have like the people within each individual place determine what is taught and how things are run.
The way the system works now is that while I'm still not trying to make it sound like a conspiracy, most of the money comes from the local level. So most of the operations going on in your school in Great Barrington are locally funded. But the federal government, and this is sort of sped up more and more over time, for a very, very small percentage of the funding, the federal government gets a very, very large percentage of control over what is taught. And this has been debated for a long time too, about having a sort of national curriculum, nationwide standards, that education is really managed on a state level, but more and more control of that time has gone to the federal government. So I guess what people are proposing as a solution is turning over the control to the actual school as far as what's being taught.
Right.
Is that correct? Okay. Well, the only problem with that is that it doesn't incentivize the people who are running the school. I mean, obviously, if the money is still changing hands the same way, you haven't really done anything to provide incentives to the people who are doing the service. That's still the problem. I think that's my opinion.
All right. Yeah, I remember seeing that a few times, and I just want to kind of, I don't know, I just kind of wanted some clarification on that, I guess. But I guess, like, outside of the kind of the teachers and things, is I remember a couple times you mentioned, like, cliques in schools. And so I guess what I'd ask is if you could kind of summarize that, I guess, maybe, so that I could even maybe use kind of that portion of this phone call as, like, in my project.
Well, I think, and I mean, you can stop me if I'm not on the right track as far as where you want to go with this, but the cliques that we see, the social cliques that we see in school, are really a phenomenon of high school. Maybe to a lesser extent middle school, but I don't think too many people would remember their elementary school being very cliquey. Like, even though in an area like Great Barrington, where I know Western Massachusetts, it's somewhat rural, but there is, like, a sort of urban area there. And you might, you know, in your elementary school, you might have had sort of some mixing of just different types of people with different types of backgrounds, with different interests. But they were more, initially, in the first few years of school, they were more willing to interact with each other. I think what happens over time is that these lessons that I talk about in school, the training in obedience, which is sort of the surrender of free thought, the training in conformity, which is really the surrender of individuality, and the training of indifference, which is really the surrender of curiosity, sort of makes the individual person, that free-thinking, unique person that we all are when we go into school, disappear a little bit. So when we get to high school, people are looking for other groups of people to validate them, that they need to be connected to another group of people, to feel like they have any worth. You know, there's no real loners in high school, and I don't mean to generalize too much, but people just sort of move in these packs. They find people that they identify with based on really whatever interests they have left, which are a lot of times things that the school creates, like sports, like the, you know, the football team sticks together, the band kids stick together, and then you have some things that are not a product of the school, like the we used to call them goth, but I think that's emo now.
Yeah.
Okay. Or is that
either way?
Is that two different groups?
You know, I'm never really sure. Sometimes I think it's the same. Sometimes I think there's two different ones.
I don't know too much about that. I'm just familiar with the terms and kind of the look, but I really don't know too much about what's behind that. So, but I mean, but we can see that there are these distinct cliques, and I really believe that it's kind of this admission that a lot of people make when they're in high school that I don't want to have the liability of being evaluated as an individual. I'm not really very confident in myself as an individual. I just kind of want to mix myself, and I'm not saying this is always this conscious, but I just want to mix myself into a group where everybody else looks the same, where I feel accepted and I get some validation for myself, because I really have a lot of trouble creating it on my own. Now, I think there might be other reasons why cliques occur, but I think that that's an important one. People aren't interested in sticking their neck out and saying, this is who I am, I'm different. That's a real liability in high school, I find.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it does seem like that's the case, because you always see that, really. It's like me walking around the school, just in the hallways, whatever, that definitely seems like it's the case.
And I told you, I think, before that I talk to kids who go to my high school, because I don't live too far from there. And in the business that I'm in, I work with kids sometimes who go to the high school that I went to in New Hampshire. And I ask them about the cliques that, you know, I said, these were the cliques that I remember. And they say, oh, yeah, yeah, still just like that. So, I mean, yeah. 14, 15 years have gone by, but not much has changed. And I really think that obviously not much has changed in how school works and how school is being taught. Not much has changed between 2009 and 1989. Not much changed between 1989 and 1949 and between 1949 and 1929. So I mean, you go in, you sit in desks. You don't know anything. The person at the front of the room does, and if you're quiet, they'll tell you about it. And that's how school worked 100 years ago, and that's basically how it works today. So the way these lessons are delivered, and I'm not even asserting that somebody sat down and consciously came up with this curriculum.
Right.
We are going to just destroy individuals. But really, at any given time in history, regardless of what somebody's intentions were, they saw the compulsory school system as a way to push a certain agenda. And in order to impose that agenda on people, they needed the people to basically be blank slates who would passively absorb whatever information that they wanted to throw at them. So I think that's how school became this institution that does teach those three lessons. I don't think it's a conscious conspiracy. I mean, it was to a large extent in Prussia, but I don't think that everybody involved in it in America is, I don't think their intentions were that malevolent, that we're just going to destroy people. They have this self-talk that they do, the common good, the greater needs of society, building, sort of collective harmony. I mean, they can really convince themselves that they're doing the right things. And I think they believe it. A lot of these people were, what we would describe today as socialists. So they wanted that uniformity in society. They wanted people kind of as pieces in a machine that would work towards what they saw as a collective good. And there's no room for individuality. There's no room for individuals in that kind of system. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. 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 'Cause I also remember just listening to, I think it was episode like 8.1, I think, of your show,
mm-hmm.
when you talk about the people that have different ideas.
Yeah.
And how, yeah, and they kind of mess things up in that whole system.
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, if you look at religious history, I mean, the fact that, you know, I grew up Catholic, right? So I did all the sacraments, first communion, I was an altar boy, I got confirmed. And what I found was that just was a spectacular path to atheism, right? Because how growing up Catholic and reflecting back on the things that I went through as a child, having that stuff foisted upon me, I'm really amazed that religion is still something that people are taking seriously. I'm really surprised that it still even exists. Really all of that, all that whole, I'll say all of Christianity. I know that might be somewhat of a controversial thing to say,
right.
But all throughout history, the church had to fight against progress because it threw their legitimacy into question. So when somebody says, well, wait a minute, maybe this is not the center of the universe. Maybe some magical being didn't create the entire universe so human beings would have a place to live. Maybe it's more complicated than that. And you know, somebody who is trying to push the human race forward scientifically was became an incredible vulnerable target because of that. So yeah, that's always been the case. It's always young people that are pushing the envelope, that are questioning the conventions that are being imposed upon them, and it's very important. And I think right now for people your age, it's an extremely exciting time because you guys grew up in a time where information was instant, where communication was easy. I mean, you and I are 160 miles away right now, talking to each other for free for as long as we want. 15 years ago, that wasn't possible. That just wasn't possible. This would be a very expensive phone call. And the other thing was, too, that 15 years ago, the odds of you finding me with 160 miles between us, just because we have, you know, I'm doing something that you're interested in and I'm interested in talking to you about that thing, we could have looked for each other for our whole lives. You know what I mean? Yeah. And never found each other. And all the people who've helped me with School Sucks podcasts, doing web design, doing logos, chipping in money, because they're like-minded. I could have searched the entire earth for those people 20 years ago and never found them. But now right. that stuff is easy. So while it's always young people who are asking the right questions, even though in school a lot of those questions are sort of beaten down and discarded, yeah. It's always young people who are questioning the conventions that they're inheriting. But now, really, I believe for the first time in history, people your age, if they're serious, have a real chance to push the world forward philosophically and in a lot of these ways that I'm talking about on my show. So I just think it's important to point out that it's always young people. When I talked about that in episode 8.1, maybe it was just an astronomer who was older and was just so amazed with what he discovered that he couldn't shut up about it, even though they told him they were going to, you know, cut his hands off or put him in house arrest or, you know, put him in the body stretching rig, whatever they would do to some, whatever awful thing that these people would do to somebody who was calling the belief system into question back then. He might have been willing to speak out, and there's always exceptions, but I think generally it's young people who are kind of like, wait a minute, I'm old enough now to know that you're full of crap, right? Yeah. Like when we're 5 or 6, adults are just amazing. They can drive cars and they're 3 feet taller than us. But when we get into high school, we're like, wait a minute, you're not so smart. And a lot of the stuff you're talking about doesn't make much sense. It's just, do we have the courage to ask the questions? And I think right now is a very exciting time to be doing that.
Right. And yeah, that's the thing. It's like when you're young, you do something, it's like, wow. And like now, you know, going back and doing some things that I used to do, like I remember that being much bigger and much cooler. And now it's not. But, and like, I've also, what I didn't, I know I've heard it a couple times, but what I've heard a lot more of recently is that like my generation is the generation of Y, which I kind of with what you were just describing about how we can go and find anything really in a matter of hours, is that really seems like a very accurate thing, because we really can just go and research really anything and question it in any way we want, and generally we'll find answers.
Yeah, and I think when every generation is 5 years old or before they entered some kind of organized formal schooling, or before they had the religious or social conventions of their family or their community imposed upon them, they were all the generation of Y. Right. And when we go into school, or we become old enough to go to church or to participate in the traditions of family or community, they start giving non-answers to the why questions. Because I said so. Because that's what God wants. Because that's the law. Right? And those aren't explanations of anything. That's just nonsense. That doesn't even make any sense. It's not even close to an answer. So those why questions are beaten out of every generation one way or another for as far back as you want to go. I think the generation Y thing might be kind of a tongue-in-cheek follow-up to Generation X. But I think it's a good point that you make, because you really can. Like, we're all curious. We all have at one time in our life this incredible desire to know things. And for people your age now, the opportunities are just limitless. Like, I work with a lot of high school kids, and I forget sometimes that most of you guys aren't old enough to remember what the world was like before the internet. Like, you just kind of, you got to an age where you wanted to start using it, and it was there. I was 18 years old. I mean, I'm not that old, but I was 18 years old before I really, really got into using the internet. And in a year and a half, or maybe 2 years, I was able to learn more for free from the internet just once I could revive my that lost childhood curiosity, I was able to get more valuable information that not only changed my philosophy, but really changed my life off the internet for free. Now, I got to tell you, I dumped $60,000 into education to have pieces of paper to say that, you know, I could do stuff or I could, you know, properly absorb the messages that teachers were throwing at me. I basically paid all that money to have a piece of paper, and there was very little value in that. But really, this is just such an exciting time. I can't stress that enough. And I always encourage young people not to take it for granted.
Yeah. I mean, it's really like even thinking of when, even just with, for me, it'd be like, my comparison to that would be like with gaming systems, because they're always coming out with new ones. But like, even when I was like 5, we had a PlayStation 1, you know, Crash Bandicoot, Tetris, whatever. But I never would think about it, but really, even most of my siblings, when they were 5, we wouldn't have had anything.
Yeah, and I remember, too, it's funny that you say that, like, Crash Bandicoot. I remember that. And for people who don't know, it was this bandicoot, which is like an Australian rat, and it would run all over the place on this incredible exotic adventure, you know, similar to like a Mario Brothers kind of game. But when that game came out, Paul, I was 18, maybe 19, and I was a freshman or a sophomore in college. And I remember hooking up that PlayStation. It was a friend of mine had it, a couple of guys that I lived with. We hooked this thing up. And we turned it on, and I said, this is the most amazing technology I have ever seen. This video game is, it looks like real life. Like real life if it was a cartoon with bandicoots. But I mean, it was like so amazing to see that, because my time with video games started 10 years before that, with the original Nintendo it was weird. You had to like blow in it to get it to work after a while. It would collect dust. But just this blocky machine that took these big cartridges, and the games were very, it was like 16-bit graphics, I think.
We actually have one of those at my house right now, because it was my dad's parents, and then it never got used, so we took it. And yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Big cartridges and, you shove them into the top and you flip the switch and hope it actually works.
Yeah. And it was amazing. I mean, those were just, when I was in fifth or sixth grade, I would rush home from school, and those were just completely wondrous times to sit there and play The Legend of Zelda or Mario Brothers. It was cutting edge technology. So now, you know, I look at how much, and we're just talking about one little tiny sector. I know when we're in high school, that sector of technology seems much larger and much more important, but just this tiny little sector of technology where the advancement in the last 10 or 15 years has been absolutely amazing. And I hope that when people are in high school and they're really into video games, that they, as they watch that develop, you know, from the time from freshman year to senior year, they're able to use that. They stop and they think about this as a measurement for all of technology. Like, this is how fast technology moves. This is how fast this computer industry, which is basically entirely free market. There's very little red tape. There's very little regulation. And it's just in the last 15 years, it's just exploded. And the advancement has been so incredible. I think if somebody was telling me when I was a senior in high school the kinds of things that I would be doing 10 or 12 years from that point, I would have thought they were insane. It would have sounded so crazy to me. And now it's stuff that most people take for granted. So I always think that's worth pointing out.
Yeah, I agree with that, because it really is. It's amazing. Like, I'm 15, and just in my lifetime, it's been from kind of just what seems like now really poor putting together of the machines into what we have now. And like, really, for at that point it wasn't, but I mean, you don't realize how like how much different it is thinking now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, that was a good little tangent there. I'm famous for my tangents. So what else can I do as far as giving you a hand with the psychology project? I think we covered what happens in education. I would really suggest that if you're trying to beef up the project, and I think I mentioned this to you before, you take a look at a branch of psychology, and I guess it kind of crosses over into philosophy a little bit too, called behaviorism. And the main guy to look at is B.F. Skinner, I think was his name. And
right.
He came up with this idea of operant conditioning, which is you could basically reward people by giving people these extrinsic motivators. You could
right.
get them to do what you wanted. Now, obviously, whenever we accomplish something that's really worthwhile, that really makes us feel good, that really helps to build our confidence in a skill or a certain area, the motivation is intrinsic. It comes from within us. It comes from a desire to want to be good at something or to want to explore something. But all of the motivators in school are purely extrinsic. You know, it's stickers and grades and parents off your back and pat on the head from the teacher and college admissions and good SAT scores. There's nothing inside you that's motivating you. Everything that you're taught that matters comes from the outside, from some kind of authority giving you a check plus or a check or a check minus. And that really, I think, in a lot of ways, that destroys people's desire to learn and their desire to want to succeed in certain areas. They just feel like they're being marched through that process. Now, I've never been able to find a real solid link between somebody like Skinner, who I think I said to you before, only probably died like 20 or 30 years ago, with the growth of public education. The public education system was already well on its way once Skinner came along. But Skinner's work is interesting to kind of get a sense of what the attitudes of a lot of the intellectuals who shaped compulsory schooling, what their attitude was. They're saying a lot of things that Skinner would have felt pretty comfortable with, like, oh yeah, I agree with that. That is what we're trying to do here. We want this operant conditioning thing. And there's a really good book that is critical of this, written by a guy named Alfie Cohen. Actually, I'd give you the title if you wanted to look it up just as a reference. It's called Punished by Rewards. And it explains this operant conditioning thing and the negative impact that it can have on young people.
Okay. Yeah, I'll have to check that out. That sounds like it should be good. And like, yeah, cause we just, finished up a unit on like conditioning and all that stuff. And, we actually watched a movie about Skinner and his pigeons. And then there's also, it was just stuff that actually it mentioned, like articles we read, mentioned like it didn't go into any detail at all really, but it mentioned like schools and
yeah
things.
Can you tell me about Skinner and his pigeons?
Well, his kind of idea, like his whole philosophy of that people could be given rewards to do pretty most anything, was what he originally did was he conditioned pigeons into doing various things. Like on the video, there's one that would play the piano. And then there were like just basic things like turning in a full circle or, play ping pong or a whole bunch of things. And actually in one article that we had in, a packet, it actually talked about how he, as a, weapons, aid for, I don't know if it was World War II, I think that was it, he found a way to, using pigeons to steer, bombs that they would drop on, like, enemy, the enemies, the Nazis or whoever they were fighting, by having them, by conditioning them to peck at a screen. I mean, it would kill the pigeon, but it would also direct the bomb where it needed to go.
Well, that's interesting that pigeons were being conditioned to sacrifice themselves for the good of the nation. I don't think that message was limited to just pigeons, but I think it's interesting too that two psychologists who were considerably who I would argue their work was considerably influential with respect to public education, Pavlov and Skinner, were both using domesticated animals as their test subjects. I think that's quite a statement.
Yeah, because they would be. They would have somewhat of the same mentality as humans being domesticated. I guess that would be.
It's hard to speculate about what they would be thinking, but I'm interested. What did your teacher have for commentary on somebody like Skinner?
A lot of the things he just kind of describes as being kind of a breakthrough in psychology. What Skinner did, and that they were really significant. Mostly we didn't have much time past just talking about what he did and then ideas that he came up with, because we had the break coming up for the holidays and whatnot. But I mean, it was mostly talking about him. There was some praise. There were a couple of times where there was some definite feeling that Skinner kind of went over the top a little bit, but mostly it was praise for him.
That's interesting. I mean, I just see the things that, you know, what his aim was as being a little bit bizarre and twisted, and it's kind of like this domestication. Like, how do we essentially domesticate human beings? And I'm kind of I guess I'm not really surprised that he didn't have much negative to say about it. I mean, I really don't know your teacher or what kind of a guy he is, but I think that there's certainly a lot of room for criticism when it comes to somebody like Skinner, and you know, that might be something that's worth bringing up once he's back in school. I'm looking here's just a quick passage about him for the record. B.F. Skinner, who died in 1990, was the most famous behaviorist. He believed that people's behavior could be changed through the process of conditioning. The famous example of conditioning involves the rat in the box. So this was called the Skinner box. I'm not sure if you guys talked about that.
Yeah.
The rat learned that if it presses a lever, a food pellet is released. This positive reinforcement ensures that the behavior will be repeated and is called operant conditioning. This is similar to the famous experiment conducted by the Russian behaviorist Ivan Pavlov. He would ring a bell every time he served his dog a meal, the end result being the dog would salivate in preparation for a snack whenever he heard the bell, even if no food was served. Skinner and his followers felt these techniques could be applied to people, and they conducted many experiments attempting to modify the behavior of humans. They learned that as far as conditioning was concerned, a human and a rat were not that far apart. His controversial book, Walden 2, outlines his vision for a utopia where good behavior was sustained by what he called positive reinforcement. All right, so he's like kind of a demented sicko as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, if you do have the time or the interest, I think that would definitely be something that's worth exploring with your teacher. And there might even be a little bit of room in this project for some criticism of somebody like Skinner.
Yeah, and actually from just something I have written down here is Skinner's kind of one of his main things was the central behavior principle. Mm-hmm. Which I don't know if you're familiar with that or no.
You might have to educate me,
okay.
I'm not sure.
Well, what he said is that people really have no free will, and they are controlled not by other people, but by their environment. And then also that he also said that the difference between humans and animals is the complexity of their environment.
Yeah, this is a very large philosophical arena, this debate between free will and determinism.
Right.
And I side on the free will position. But you know, a lot of stuff that I just kind of was skimming through this as I was reading and then listening to what you just said, he just sounds like somebody who spent a little bit too much time with pigeons and rats and not enough time maybe trying to have you know, quality authentic relationships with other human beings. Now, obviously that's complete speculation, but I think in school and really to maybe to a greater extent in higher education and college, we're taught that we should be taking certain psychologists seriously because they're famous. I mean, Freud is another one. Freud, the only reason that people in America have ever even heard of Sigmund Freud, I would assert, is because his nephew was a guy named Edward Bernays, who basically invented public relations, trying to make use of a lot of these same principles that we're talking about with people like Skinner, that human beings are essentially just another dumb animal that can be controlled if or you know, you can get some kind of end, some kind of desirable end to the managers of society by using the right techniques to control them. And I think that this is a very, very twisted idea, but Bernays was so good at using public relations that I think he was able to make his uncle Sigmund famous. Because I think in a lot of ways Freud is a quack. You know, I mean, he's not somebody that I think people who are really studying psychology today would take incredibly seriously. Now, I'm not a psychologist. I've never taught psychology. And to be completely honest with you, I haven't even done much independent study on that, you know, entire spectrum or that entire subject. But I would say that a lot of these ideas that were being put forward by these people are very, very twisted and very, very sad. And really, I don't know what reward they thought there would be in trying to lump human beings together with very simple, domesticated animals. I think it's kind of sad. And I think what's especially sad is how they're revered, in high school and college psychology classes.
Yeah. And that's what we talked about, Freud and a bunch of other people earlier. And actually, I'd never heard of his nephew before, which I find kind of interesting. But yeah.
Well, you know, you can go on YouTube for absolutely for free, and you can watch a movie called Century of the Self. It's a British documentary, and it's like 4 hours long. But I think if you watch the first 45 minutes of it, you really might get some helpful hints for what you're trying to do with this project. It's not too focused on education, but it's really focused on how these sort of shadowy intellectuals thought they could manage and centrally plan society by controlling the behavior and really influencing the desires of the masses. So that's another thing that's worth checking out too. It's called Century of the Self. And it talks about Bernays and it talks about Freud. And Freud's daughter, Anna, was also involved in this to a large extent, and she's covered in the movie as well. But that's worth checking out, really, just because I think some of it you'll find somewhat shocking. Bernays actually also lived into the 1980s, and there are some interviews with him as a very old man in the film, talking about the things that he did in a sort of a nonchalant way, like these things were okay, this was just my job, this is what I did, these people hired me, and it is what it is. So I think you might find that interesting as well.
Okay, that's good to know, thank you. And the man you mentioned at the beginning of this call, Stéphane Molyneux?
Stéphane Molyneux is a podcaster and an author who runs a website called Free Domain Radio. He covers a variety of topics. It's pretty heavy on philosophy, but he does a lot of really good work on history, on politics, on economics, and he's got like 1500 plus podcasts on the on his website or on iTunes. He has a YouTube channel called StephBot. That's StephBot. It seems like he's basically doing a YouTube video for just about everything that's a podcast. I think he's been doing that for a while. He's always done videos, but he's just a phenomenal debater. He's a very good, very engaging presenter and speaker. And I think that there's a lot that young people would find very, very attractive about his work. Well, we're on the subject because I was just talking with both of these guys today. My friend Wes Bertrand, who does have a very, very strong background in psychology. And, you know, if you went to his website, CompleteLiberty.com, and you look through some of his podcasts, you might also find some helpful information related specifically to the topic of psychology. He's done a lot of really, really super work on self-esteem. He and I did an education series about a year ago. It's in there as well. He's pretty thorough in naming the episode, so it's pretty easy to find what you're looking for. But the resources, there's just a tremendous amount of resources, and I think if you start exploring those two guys, you might just open up doors to other paths that are really worth exploring as well. Wes specifically is very good about linking the things that he talks about in his show notes. So, I mean, Complete Liberty could become, a year's worth of free time, just taking up exploring all the things that he's done in the last couple of years. He actually wrote a book a few years ago called The Psychology of Liberty. And, he's done a lot of good work on his own on the topic of education and public education as well. And what real education should be. He and I, really agree on a very student-centered model, of education. If this could even really take place in some kind of organized school setting, I don't know, but it's kind of, the things that we're most interested in all fit under this umbrella term called unschooling, where schooling is essentially being robbed of your individuality, being robbed of your curiosity and that childhood uniqueness. And unschooling, as the name implies, is very much about getting that stuff back or never having it stolen from you at all. So it's a form of homeschooling. There are schools that use unschooling models to some extent, but that's worth checking out too. And I mean, you and I could sit here and do 25 podcasts on things worth checking out, for a young person who's starting to discover these things. But I really think that list of resources that I just gave you, you might find all of it very valuable. And if you have any friends who are interested, certainly share it with them as well.
Yeah, no, I definitely will. Yeah, that is a big help, though. Thank you. I meant to spend all today kind of researching different things. I didn't get to start until like 4 or 5 o'clock, but I was looking up stuff for a while and I was having some trouble finding, good resources. And I did actually, I used the link on your website to get to, a couple of episodes from the Complete Liberty, and I did find some useful things on there. So that is very good.
So the only other thing that I wanted to ask you about, or maybe see if I could help you out with a little bit, was you told me you had read Jonathan Taylor Gatto's article Against School, and I just wanted to see if you had any thoughts.
All right. Well, I didn't write down many notes or anything on that. I plan to go back and kind of look through it again, but I mean, while I was reading it, some of the things that he was describing, well, originally it was how he had his job terminated and license taken away because he was on a medical leave that they destroyed the evidence of, which I found that really kind of appalling. But I mean, there was a lot of things in there, and I honestly can't say I remember too many specifics, but Well, oh, one thing I remember. I don't remember if it was that article or if it was a different one that I had read. I know it was by Gatto, but he was talking about how the students that they were teaching at one point were almost like, or I guess not at one point, but students they were teaching were like authority addicts. I found that kind of an interesting concept, that they like needed somebody to tell them what to do.
Yeah, I've certainly encountered that a lot with the students that I've worked with. When, you know, I know you probably haven't done the SAT yet, but the SAT is very much a critical thinking kind of test. So that's I keep talking about it because it's a big part of my my profession right now. So it's always like, you know, examples are always right at the front of my mind. But I talked in an earlier episode about how I encountered some frustration on the part of students who were really just sort of like, well, what's the formula to do a problem like this? And I was like, well, you know, there isn't just a formula that you can plug in. Like, here's a problem, here's a formula, stick them together, and then go on to the next thing. Like, you really have to think critically and maybe even a little bit creatively about how to solve this problem. And it's a very common attitude in school, where school doesn't just teach us how to be told what to do. It teaches us how to want to be told what to do, because we become so comfortable with that format. You know, like there's always, we don't have to go into school and plan our day. You know, we don't have to go into school. And I shouldn't even say like it's a burden or it's an obligation. It would be a beautiful thing if a young person could get up focused on learning and plan their day every day about what they wanted to learn. But and that's also an issue of intrinsic motivation. When people are robbed of that intrinsic motivation that I also believe is strong when we're young, you know, we're very willful as little children. We want to do this. We want to know why. We want to know how. But once we go into that schooling environment, that tends to fade, because somebody else is always, we are the people in school who don't know. And the person at the front of the room is the person who supposedly knows. So we sit there passively and we absorb information. If we're put in a situation where the knowing person is suddenly vanished and we have to figure out something, you know, out for ourselves, because of schooling, I would say a lot of people tend to find that situation somewhat uncomfortable.
Right.
But he called that authority addicts, huh?
Yeah, I don't remember if that was actually Gatto. I know it was a link that I followed, and it was a teacher who talked about, I believe that was the term they used, yes, authority, yes. Like authority addiction.
Yeah, that's either way, that's pretty clever, and I think it's really a good summary of what happens. But yeah, you know, I just really think in closing that article is sort of a good framework to build a project that's focused on public education upon. You know, Gatto was good because he taught in school for 30 years,
right?
But he also went and did his homework, for lack of a better word, about the history of public education and the intentions behind public education and the personalities that shaped public education at different times in history. I mean, it went through a couple of phases of really, really large-scale growth where, the intentions were more religious, I think, initially, and then it was more about having a manageable labor force, and then I think it even became a little bit about having reliable, obedient foot soldiers to march in front of bullets. But all those three things were all goals of compulsory education in the last 150 years in this country. And Gatto does a really good job of laying that out in not only a really comprehensive way, but also in a very confronting way. Like, I remember the first time I read that, I think I was in grad school, and it just blew my mind. You know, here I was forking over cash to get this certificate to be able to go into public schools and call myself a history teacher. And here's this guy who taught for 30 years telling it like it is. And it was really a turning point in my life. So I really recommend revisiting that. Is there anything else that you can think of? If you certainly have any other questions for me, or as the project goes on and you want some additional support. I mean, I tend to be less interested in helping people do well in school, and I tend to be more interested in seeing if I can help people with the things that they're interested in. So I certainly appreciate you seeking me out, you asking me these questions, and you know, I commend you for wanting to take the project in this direction, which is kind of a risky one, maybe. But yeah. I'm really glad that you enjoy the show and that you're getting something valuable out of the show. And I'm also grateful to your teacher. I only knew him by his first name. I'm sure you call him Mr. something, but I know that that he had found the show and he had told a couple people about it. So I certainly appreciate him doing that as well. And if you talk to him, I never heard back from him regarding. I sent him an email and never heard anything back a while ago. And I was interested in chatting a little bit more with him. And if it was possible, maybe even making a trip down there to talk to one of his classes or something. If I might be dreaming, to think that that's possible.
That's the case. If you tried to make it, maybe his last period honors sophomore's English class.
Yeah.
That would be great. That's my class, and the other student who emailed you, that's his class too. I know him. He and I have kind of talked a little bit too about your show, and I know that we would both find that very. I don't know the right word, but a very rewarding experience.
And I really, you know, I don't really try to make the show about I'm a guy that has a clear path that you should follow or definite solutions that you can pursue. But the show is about, you know, here's a lot of questions that you can start asking yourself, right. Your friends, your teachers, your parents, and you can learn a lot about what's going on by the answers that you get back. And you know, really, I'm much more about questions than conclusions. And school is all about conclusions. Like the questions are sort of prescribed, and the conclusions are already known. And I'm not trying to do anything like that. So it's really just about questions. And you know, I'm glad that people are talking about the show and liking the show. It means a lot to me. But if you have any other thing that you need help with, if you want to chat again, shoot me an email. We'll jump on Skype. We can chat, or I can try to answer any questions or point you in any direction that you think would be helpful.
Okay, thank you very much.
No problem, Paul. You have a good night.
You too.
All right, bye.
Bye.